Rob Osler, you wrote the novel Devil's Chew Toy. And one thing I wanted to say, I'm happy to see more diversity in novels these days. In the past, LGBTQ books weren't as diverse as they should be. And in your novel, it's obvious when you wrote it, diversity was intentional. Am I correct?
Absolutely. As my character would say, 1,000%.
What was your decision to do that? Why did you see a need?
I did see a need. For me, when I crawl up in bed at the end of the night, I wanted to read what is generally called a cozy, you know, a novel that is free of profanity, free of sex, free of gratuitous violence. But I wanted gay and lesbian and transgender and all of the rainbow of LGBTQ characters represented in that story. And so that's what I ended up writing, is something that I wanted selfishly to read.
Hold on, because I want to talk a little more about that.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, I'm Brad, and welcome. Rob Osler is with me. Rob's brief writing career is impressive. His first mystery short story, Analog, was published in the 2021 in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine and won the 2022 Robert L. Fish Award as part of the Mystery Writers of America annual Edgar Awards. Not too shabby, I may say. In his first novel, Devil's Chew Toy, it was released earlier this year and has been well received. Rob, welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. It's nice to meet a neighbor, even though you're here in the desert. You are on the opposite side of the mountain. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm super delighted to be here. I've been excited about this for quite some time.
Well, it's a delight to have you on. And, you know, the internet plays games sometimes with me. I said Devil's Chew Toy is your first novel, and I just want to make sure, is that correct?
That is correct, yep.
Okay, because sometimes people write novels and then they get taken down. So glad to hear I had that right. Going back to what we said in the opening about diversity, one thing I say is I'm really happy to, when I read the novel, that you, in addition to a gay man, you have two lesbians, one of whom is black. You have Camilo, who is a go-go boy, and he goes missing, and he is a dreamer part of the DACA program. And then you have a 99-year-old man. And one thing I'm really happy about him is he's not a dithering old stereotype who's mean son of a bitch, and he's not there for laughs either. He's a 99-year-old guy.
Yeah. I wish I'd made him younger. He's only 91.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't mean to age him in years.
I know. That's one of my one thing I wish I could do over is to make him, you know, he didn't have to be 91. Let's see how long he lasts in the series.
So I'm guessing when you say that, as the series go on, you anticipate your character's aging?
I do, but not much. You know, like right now, Hayden, the main character, is 25. So in the next book, you know, he's 25 and a half or 26. So fairly, I'm going to go fairly slowly, at least for the second one.
Okay. So not, they'll age, but not in real time.
Oh, correct. Yes.
It won't be like Richard Stevenson's Donald Strachey movie, where over the period, I think 2 decades, they may have aged 5 years or so, maybe a little more than that. Now, with Devil's Chew Toy, it's a cozy mystery. What made you choose to write a cozy?
I love this question because it was not my intention to write a cozy. In fact, my editor at Crooked Lane, the publisher, who I adore, by the way, Sarah J. Henry, she was the first to label the book as a cozy. She said, you know, this is a gay cozy. And I was like, is it really? Because my intention was to write a lighthearted book with friendship at the center that was free of drug use, that was free of gratuitous sex, a lot of violence. I didn't want the gay or the lesbian characters to be either the villains or the victims, or for them to be nasty to one another. That was what I wanted to do. There's no judgment about books that do other things. That's just the book that I wanted to write. So when Sarah read it, she's like, yeah, what you've written is a gay cozy. So again, my intention wasn't to write to that subgenre specifically. That's just the genre that I kind of, I guess, naturally fell into in the story.
It was just the type of book you wanted to write, and boom, there it was.
Truly, yeah.
One thing I found interesting is Hayden, the protagonist, is a gay man, and you have lesbians in the book, which other authors have included both gay and lesbians, but they are very prominent. And you don't see that mix often, or I think enough, in novels. It seems like you have a gay novel or a lesbian novel, and maybe they have a sidekick that is the opposite. Was that part of your choice to add the diversity to that? And was it difficult?
It was a choice, and no, it wasn't difficult. I was really intrigued by the idea of unlikely friendships, right? And as you say, it's like, if you just take the gay bar setting, which is, you know, pretty familiar to gay guys, there's, you know, girl bars and boy bars. And we were talking earlier about, you know, small towns. I grew up in Boise, Idaho, where there wasn't a boy bar and a girl bar. There was an LGBT bar. We didn't call it that. We just called it a gay bar. But it catered to everybody who was other than straight. And I like that diversity. To me, it's far more interesting. And I love the pairing of diminutive, shy, mild-mannered Hayden, who's crafted after me in a lot of respects, with larger-than-life, take charge, almost too much confidence for her own good, butch lesbian Hollister, who's, you know, his partner in crime. And I like their physical juxtaposition, which is completely different, their personality differences. They have something in common, which is to find their friend, and that unites them. And they go off on, you know, what Katrina McPherson calls a pacey romp. And so that was very intentional to show that unlikely friendships can become some of the strongest friendships, because it's what unites them that is really special. And their differences, they're wildly different people, but that pales in comparison into the bond they form during this crazy romp across Seattle in 300 pages, which I intentionally made about as silly as I could without losing all reality whatsoever in the book.
Well, I got to say, I like it. It was refreshing. And commenting on the small-town gay bar, I lived in Stockton, California for a while, and please pity me for doing that because it was it was pure hell. But we did have one gay bar, and it was literally on the other side of the tracks. It was the Everything Bar. You had drag queens, you had leather guys, you had pretty much every stereotype there was, and those that don't necessarily fit any of those molds, right there all together having a great time. And some nights they would have leather night, and sometimes they would have drag queen night, but everybody was there. And I think that was great. I would love to see more of that.
Yeah. I just think it's just far more colorful. It's far more interesting to me, right? It, like, some people pick a lane and they want that experience, you know, when they go out or, you know, whatever it might be, or in their books, right?
Yeah.
But for me, I liked it to be truly more diverse and more interesting, right? That's why you referenced 91-year-old Jerry. I have some dear older friends of that age, and it's like, I love spending time with them. So when I was writing the story, I wanted to include them and their point of view and their life experience. Even though Jerry's not a really primary character, he appears in several chapters. But I just thought, you know, in the spirit of the more the merrier, I thought he added a lot. And for the plot, right, he was the guy who was kind of the smarty pants of the operation, that Hayden could discuss what was going on in the story with him, and they would figure out the clues together. And so he served a purpose in advancing the story, as well as including a perspective of a straight guy who's Jewish, who's 91, which is very different than Hayden, very different than Hollister, very different from Burley, different from the other main characters.
If you you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
We've had several authors on this show that have protagonists that are older, and they did it purposeful because they didn't feel like there was enough older representation. I'm not going to name names because one of them is totally, I'm blanking on, so I yeah, they saw the need. They saw the need to have older characters, so they had older sleuths, Jessica Fletcher's age. So I commend you for adding an older character. We're not all under 30.
I mean, yes. And, you know, just as a sidebar, I guess this is all just a series of sidebars in many ways, but I was just in San Francisco because my partner of 22 years had a booth at the San Francisco Pride. And it's back to the diversity within the LGBTQ plus community. There was a little bit of everything. And it's just, mm-hmm. it's a reminder that, yeah, there are gays and lesbians that are well into their 80s and are at Pride and are marching at Pride. And it's not just the gay bar experience where it's guys in their 20s. It's a whole community. And I love that. And in my own little way, in my 320 pages, I tried to at least, you know, nod toward that.
Well, along those lines, I want to get into the book right now. And I want to start by talking about your protagonist, Hayden McCall. And I want to tell you, I have a big problem with Hayden. And that problem is he's reserved. He doesn't have rippling abs. And I didn't find a single graphic sex scene in the entire book. And in fact, I checked Amazon yesterday, and out of the 7 of the top 10 LGBTQ mystery novels, 7 of them had sexy men on the cover. And you have a dog collar. So I have to ask, what the hell is wrong with you?
That was so purposeful because to me, and again, it's truly, Brett, it's like this is not coming from a place of judgment. It's just coming from a place of what I'm into and what interests me. In that I call them the torso covers. And it's like torso, torso, torso. And if you go to, like here in Palm Springs, the local shop, which is like a gay variety shop, you can get everything from gay-themed cards to like more racy sexual accessories. And then there's a book section. And it's torso, 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 torso. And I'm like, there's more to LGBTQ books that feature an LGBTQ plus main protagonist and themes. And themes kind of always bothers me because I'm like, I'm not sure what the themes are, but we can maybe talk about that later. But there's more than just the sex angle and the torso angle. And I get that like one of the biggest genres within the LGBTQ kind of fiction world is male-on-male mm-hmm. romance. And that's what a lot of those are that you're referring to, if not all of them. And they're out there and they're great and there's big readership for those and that's awesome. But I picked another lane and I purposefully, I love your comments about Hayden, by the way, because I didn't make him big and he's not like hot. I mean, there's a point where he talks about like, you know, I'd love, people just keep calling me adorable, you know, which is good for like gurgling babies or maybe puppies. It makes me crazy. I want somebody to call me hot. But, you know, mm-hmm. he's got this shock of orange red hair that an ex-boyfriend called the color of a Cheetos bag. He's 5'4". He's a ginger. He looks younger right out of the gate. The go-go boy who you mentioned earlier goes missing early in the story, which is the mystery. Actually, he said, you know, how old are you? You know, and he got defensive about that. It's like, I'm 25. I mean, he's the same age as the go-go boy, but he looks young. I purposely made him out not to be a stud because I didn't want to fall into that kind of trope of male-on-male romance and sexy because a lot of us, like, I've never had a six-pack. And now at my age, I'm never going to have one. And that's okay, right? It's like there's a place for all of us in these stories. And sure, Camillo, the go-go boy, is hot. Because guess what? He's a go-go boy. It kind of goes with the territory. But also, that's the dynamic of why Hayden is so tongue-tied around him, because it's like, what is this super hot dude doing with me, and why is he giving me the time of day? And that's what a lot, you know, that's what I feel when I went out to bars, even when I was that age. Always just kind of feeling a bit of the outsider, and it's like, I'm not really hot enough to, like, get up on the platform and dance like my friends. That's a real thing, and I wanted to bring that to life within Hayden. Because frankly, I think hopefully if I've done my job, he's more relatable to a lot of guys, because most of us aren't, you know, 9.5s.
I was listening to a podcast recently, and it's a very popular show, and I'm blanking on the host's name, but he's out of Australia. And he said he blames the gay community for his fear of coming out just as much as he does the homophobes. And it's because he didn't live up to that stereotype that we see in Pride and what's expected for a gay man to look like. I think probably a lot of other people could probably relate to that.
Well, yeah, because Pride festivals are a really interesting thing, the parades especially. And it's funny, it's like in the second book, I have a little line about that, that, you know, we have more differing opinions on Pride parades than just about anything, right? But we kind of exalt the gay body, and I'm speaking specifically to, like, gays within the LGBTQ canopy, because we actually literally put them on stage and put them on platforms and put them on floats, and great, it's eye candy. That's all good. And we put them on covers for nightlife publications about, you know, bars and parties and all that. But if you allow yourself to focus on it too much, it's a little dispiriting, frankly, if you don't look that way. It's like, well, where am I? Where am I in that rainbow? And it's like, the reality is there's very few guys that meet that standard of beauty. And more power to you if you are. It also just, I find it just not interesting to, like, frame a whole character on being beautiful, or a beautiful man with other beautiful men and a whole book of beautiful people running around, because I can't relate to it, right? I relate to Burley, who is literal giant, nearly 7 feet tall, over 300 pounds, and a stoner with Willie Nelson braids, who wears cowboy boots and is hosting a lesbian kegger in her backyard. Because that's the party I want to go to. I don't want to go to this super hot 9.8 out of 10 good-looking guy party, because I'm not going to feel comfortable there, quite honestly. I'd much rather go to the lesbian kegger party. I'm going to have a better time. So I was very selfish in many ways in my intent in writing the book. Because these are people that I wanted to hang out with, and experiences that I wanted to have that, for me, would be a lot more fun. And hopefully there's enough readers that think it's a lot more fun.
And I've got to admit, it was Pride parades, watching them on TV, that was part of keeping me in the closet. You know, I'm like, there's so much over the top. And I got to say, now I love over the top. But when you're afraid to come out and you think, okay, I have to act like that, that was a scary thought. And I'm not ashamed to admit, transgender folk freak me out, because I'm like, I'm a man. I want to stay a man. And I feel confident in saying that, because anybody that knows me, that has totally changed. But that was that was difficult for me, because there weren't guys that looked like me that you saw on a regular basis. In fact, I had a neighbor who was from rural Louisiana. He fluctuated back and forth on, am I gay? Am I not gay? And he was so confused. And he kind of decided he must not be gay, because he was looking at guys and they weren't attracted to him, sort of. And then he got on the internet and he found the bear community. And he said, oh my God, I'm gay. Exactly.
He found his tribe.
Yeah, we all aren't gorgeous. Though I will admit, I've had a six pack almost my entire life. You just kind of have to search around in there to find it.
There you go.
And regarding the dog collar on the cover, there's a lot of people that would be really excited about a collar on the cover, but I'm kind of talking about a different collar, and we would be talking about a whole different kind of story.
Oh, The cover, oh my goodness, Brad, the cover, and if anybody from the publisher, you know, hears this, it's like, it's all good because it was all out in the open between us. But we had a cover struggle because mm-hmm. it is a gay cozy, right? So what cues do you send? There's no hint of a rainbow flag on the cover. It's not pink. You know, there's certain telltale cues that if you're at the, you know, if you're at Barnes & Noble or better yet, your indie bookstore in your local community, right? And you're just scanning the shelf. I wanted something that said, oh, hey, however subtle, that was just like, oh, is that like for me? Is that like, could that be an LGBTQ+ book? And there's really nothing on the cover that does that. So the collar, which is suggestive of Devil's Chew Toy, you know, conceptually it fits. There is a bull terrier in the story. Animals figure into the story. So it's not a complete miscue. But yes, you could take that to be some sort of S&M domination sex thing. And again, I was mentioning Sarah J. Henry, my editor, and she was particularly concerned about the message that the dog collar might send. Because, you know, and you also have devil, you know, in the title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you take all those things, you know, there's a couple cues that could send people in the wrong direction. And it's not a typical cozy cover, right? They tend to be kind of watercolory pastels.
And food a lot.
A lot of food, a lot of animals, a small setting, all of those telltale cues that are signaling to the cozy reader that this is a cozy, appropriately so. But I didn't want to do that, and I didn't want to be too punny in the title, which is another very, you know, overt cozy cue. But yeah, the collar, I have misgivings about the collar still, that, you know, if you are just passing the book on the shelf and you see devil tied with the collar, you know, that you might get the idea that the book is about something that it's not. But hopefully it hasn't been.
I didn't see that.
Too much of a.
I can see where somebody may get that, but I don't think most would. Most would. But I don't want to belabor the point because I'm sorry, listener out there. I always say I'm not going to get on my high horse about this, but I am going to get on my high horse about this because we've touched on the subject. And that is, again, going back to the top 10 LGBTQ mysteries having the torsos on the cover. And if you go beyond the top 10, the top 50, it continues. And my big pet peeve with that is most of those are not mysteries. They're romance novels that have a mystery in them. And I have no problem with that. Romances that have a mystery in them, they do it on the Hallmark Channel. It's been a trope that's been done many, many times for romance readers. And I say, go for it. But they are in the mystery section. And I have a real, when I think of some of the outstanding mystery writers there are, and they're down the list because of this long grouping of what I considered mislabeled romance, I have big issues with that. And somebody may argue with me. I always say, if you want to argue with me, come on the show and I'll have you on so we can discuss it. Nobody's taking me up on it, but if you would like want to, I will make a special edition for you. So now I'm done with my high horse. I think you would, I'm guessing you would agree with me in some sense.
I completely 1,000% agree with you on that one. Just a quick riff. I mean, like, where is Michael Nava? Right? Where is John Copenhaver? Right? Where is Marshall Thornton? All those guys, and I could go on and on and on. They should be 1, 2, 3. That's my personal opinion. But right there, as you say, there are some terrific gay mystery, true mystery writers. I'm not saying that they're not successful or they haven't got some, you know, great deserved acclaim, but like those three guys, boom, boom, boom. And again, I risk mentioning them because I'm not mentioning so many others, but there's so many that deserve to be in those top rankings mm-hmm. instead of all of the torsos that, as you say, are really romance with a little bit of mystery, and they are miscategorized and they dilute the field. And I think they just make it harder to find the really good mysteries by LGBTQ.
And I would say when they release, their books do shoot up to the top, but they don't stay there very long. And not to brag, my first book hit number one. And I was excited, told the whole world, and it didn't stay there very long. All the torso guys popped right back up. So yeah, it's very frustrating for, and what bothers me the most is that is what some people are learning a mystery is. An example regarding romance, Christopher Rice, who I consider an outstanding writer, he wrote his first, he doesn't call it a male-male mystery, but it is what many people would categorize as a male-male mystery. And I'm sure he sold quite well, but when you look at the rankings, he's not very high up there. And my belief is because he probably wrote a true romance story that what it is like between two gay men and not this whole, you know, everybody likes the fictionalized version, not everybody, but people like this fictionalized version of what romance is like, and it gets tossed into gay romance, but sometimes it's just plain wrong. They just don't get it at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, off my high horse, I won't bring it up the rest of the show, or at least I don't plan to. Now, in the book, Hayden McCall writes a blog, and it's titled Mates on Dates, which I got to say is very cute. And on your website, I noticed that you have Hayden's blog, which I am going to ask a little bit more about. But what prompted you to make him a blogger?
That was a way, actually, you know, in a way to kind of like add irony to his character, that someone who's so shy and mild-mannered and who grouts to the bars, you know, and kind of stands on the sidelines with his cider is actually dispensing kind of relationship advice. He feels very comfortable at home, you know, talking about these things. But, you know, when he's in the arena at the gay bar, he's very pulled back and very reserved. So I thought it was a device, you know, obviously, to allow his character to have dimension and for him to really kind of share his true, I mean, he is a romantic at heart, right? So in those blog posts, he's able to talk about his truly sincere desire for a boyfriend. Right. And it's like hookups are easy, even though it, as we talked about, it's kind of a default cozy. So he doesn't like have any hookups, and he's not a prude, but he really wants something more. And so in those blog posts, he's able to, you know, hey, readers, of which he's got like, you know, 14, he's able to talk about his true desires and kind of reveal himself that he doesn't have an opportunity to do with like his evangelical aunt, who we haven't talked about. She's very much like a tertiary character, or with Jerry, you know, I mean, he talks a lot with Jerry, the 91-year-old, but you know, he's not going to talk about, you know, being a gay 25-year-old guy. Hollister has her own girl problems. And, you know, she is, as much as she learns to really kind of love Hayden, she never really, you know, her response is just like, you know, just get your big boy pants on and get out there and, you know, like have some fun. That's where he can really kind of reveal himself and his vulnerabilities and his real desire to just want a boyfriend. And hopefully some of them are kind of humorous.
Well, I want to say I found it clever that you put his blog on your website. I was disappointed there's only two entries. Do you plan to add more in the future?
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly under the category of just get it in gear, Rob. Write more of those. Yeah.
It's a good marketing tool, and it was fun to read. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. I appreciate you notice those. I need to write more of them because I get a kick out of them. They're fun, and it keeps Hayden fresh in my mind as well.
Yeah, and that sometimes can be hard to do.
Yeah.
So we're going to do what I call Beyond the Blurb. And what that is sure, we have your blurb on Amazon and other websites, but that's not enough for me. I want to hear more about what the story. Obviously, you can't tell the whole story.
Right.
It's a mystery. The last thing we want to do is that. But give me more than what is on the blurb. Let's tell the story.
Yeah. So for that, I'm going to give you what I call a checklist for a fun mystery read. And I could do this in like a minute. So first, a main character who is a redheaded, mild-mannered, 25-year-old middle school teacher, and as we discussed, part-time gay relationship blogger. Check. We've got that. An improbable mishap involving a go-go boy at a Seattle dance club. Check. A mysterious disappearance, a police investigation, and a bull terrier hiding beneath the bed. Check. a black butch lesbian sporting an impressive mohawk, who actually has the physique of Serena Williams, by the way, who joins our ginger sleuth in searching for the missing go-go boy. Check. A midnight visit to the overgrown compound of a sinister gun dealer. Check. Clues that lead our unlikely crime-fighting duo to a marvel of a pet store named Barkingham Palace. Say it with me. Check. A high-security warehouse and a diabolical international crime ring. Check. A speedboat rescue and a mysterious island estate. Check. And finally, a surprising ending that reveals... And for that, my friends, you have to read Devil's Chew Toy.
Well, thank you for not finishing that sentence.
It hurts book sales.
Yes, it does. It's like a movie trail that sometimes I watch a movie trail. I'm like, why the hell should I go to the movie? I know everything that happens. So I mentioned earlier that the cast and your characters are quirky and fun. And as I said earlier, they're almost equal to Hayden, the protagonist, as in some points. So tell me about some of them a little more in depth. Let's get to know them.
Yeah. So the second main character is Hollister. I never give her a last name. I don't even have a last name in mind for her. Maybe at some point she'll get a last name. I just like her being like Hollister, like, you know, Madonna or Adele or something like that. But Hollister is a, like I was mentioning, she's a large in stature. Again, just think Serena Williams with a mohawk who only wears black. And she's got girl trouble. She's had a series of girlfriends. In the book, she only really has the one girlfriend who is kind of like the arch nemesis of Hayden named Misty, who is a beautiful Vietnamese American woman. Hayden describes them as going together like a tiara and sweatpants. So Hollister will confide in Hayden at times about, you know, her girl troubles, and Hayden very much, you know, listens, and it's one way that they bond, and that she shows her vulnerability, because even though she's on the surface, you know, very confident and very bold and very take charge, you know, what you see is what you got a problem kind of personality, really inside she's very vulnerable, like he is when it comes to relationships and romance. They both want something special. But they both come at relationships with their own vulnerabilities and insecurities, and it's something that unites them. As an occupation, she is a high-end furniture designer, and she owns her own business. She drives a black Porsche that she named Mo, short for Toni Morrison. There's a joke in the book that, you know, Hayden's like, oh, Mo for like momentum. And she's like, no, Toni Morrison. He's like, oh, the writer. Oh, you've heard of him. It's like, nope. It's like, oh, yeah, thought so. Right? Because, you know, he's just like this little white guy. And she's like, you've heard of Toni Morrison? And it's like, of course he hasn't. I do my best, you know, we all do our best, whether we're successful at the end of the day, you know, who knows, to make her, you know, multidimensional. So she's not just a stereotypical big, I'm a big black butch lesbian. Sure, fine, you know, fine. That's what she is. But she's so much more. If nothing else, she's a really good-hearted and dear friend to Hayden. I mean, she's got his back throughout the story. Another character, kind of like the third in the line of main characters, is Burley. Burley is a literal giant. She stands nearly 7 foot tall. She's about 300 pounds. She's a stoner. She's running a ganja farm in her basement. She also raises emus in the backyard. But if I stopped there, she might be a little one note. So I made her an acclaimed baker. She's got her own bakery cafe. It's an old house in Seattle that she's turned into a bakery. And she's won awards, and she's got a huge following, and she's got a craft that she's incredibly proficient in. And then, you know, just when you think, you know, she's a total stoner and she would act like a toner stoner, she has an incredible memory. One point late in the book, she's like, yes, you know, whales and elephants, Hayden, whales and elephants, big brains, big memories. And so, again, I'm trying to like play with that unexpected of just when you think this is like a one-note character and you've got them figured out, it's like, oh, wait, there's much more to them than I thought. And I think that really stems from You know, the fact that, you know, we go back to Hayden. He's gay. Yeah, sure. He's gay. Check that box. That's all you need to know about his gayness.
Mm-hmm.
There's way so much more. His blogging is way more interesting. His reflections on like being a school teacher and having to deal with, you know, middle schoolers is more interesting in many respects that, you know, than his gayness. Kirk has called it a fresh new take on the gay mystery. And I bristle at that in some respects, although, you know, and I like it in others, because I'm like, what's gay about the mystery? If I really, you know, parse the language, there's nothing gay about the mystery. It just happens to be that some of these characters identify as LGBTQ+, and they're thrown in what I hope is like an intriguingly, you know, an interesting mystery.
Well, you mentioned Seattle. I'm curious about one thing. You have moved quite a bit. You were born in Boise. I know you've lived in Chicago. You've lived in Seattle. You lived in San Francisco, and I'm probably missing some other locations, and I now know you live in Southern California. Out of all those, why did you choose Seattle as the location?
Like, Seattle is like my spirit city. I just love Seattle. I went to undergrad in Tacoma, Washington, which is just 30 miles south of Seattle. And the first time I got to Seattle, some friends, my freshman year, we took a road trip up there, and it was like, this place is magical. We went to Pike Market, and, you know, they're throwing the fish and all that stuff. And I just immediately was smitten by the city. I went on to live there after graduate. There was a, as you mentioned, there was a stint in Chicago for 5 years. And then I moved back to Seattle, where I lived a cumulative amount of time for about 18 years. And I just loved the water and the mountains and the city and the vibe. And so when I chose a setting, actually, there's an interesting kind of anecdote in here. When I chose the setting, I first chose Boise, Idaho. And then I moved on because I frankly, no dissing to Boise, but I just didn't want to spend as much time there as I was going to spend in writing the book and hopefully a series. I then switched it to Seattle, where I was able to join Hayden and Hollister on a speedboat across Elliott Bay. I was able to, you know, zoom from where his aunt and Jerry live in Finney Ridge over to Ballard, where Barkingham Palace is. I was able to spend time in a city that I truly love. I promised an anecdote about first setting it in Boise. I gave a book top, fantastic bookstore, Rediscovered Books in downtown Boise, which is, again, I can't say enough good things about this book, and especially with libraries coming under attack in Idaho and all this kind of stuff and book censorship. They are fighting the fight. They're awesome. But I did a book event there, and it was the first time I remembered to share this little nugget in the story, because there's something that the names Hayden McCall, Hollister, Burley, her last name is Driggs, Burley Driggs. There's a fictional new country western star in the book whose latest hit, Fallen Hard, keeps playing throughout the radio. His name is Stanley Kellogg. So there is something that all of those names have in common. And I'm guessing that you don't know what that is.
Well, I'm presuming they are either prominent people or street names in Boise.
They are all either, you're very, very close. They're either towns or counties in the state of Idaho.
Ah.
All of them.
Well, and plus, I'm sure Boise has a larger gay community than any of us would think. People don't think Salt Lake would have a gay community, and it's a thriving community. So I'm sure there is one in Boise as well. But my guess is to have a cast of characters that are as out as your individuals are, it would be harder to do in Boise than it would be in Seattle. Am I right?
It would be. And here's also an element to the story that I admit is unabashedly commercially based. Right? That it's like, I think stories set in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Seattle, pick your larger city, people might argue with me on this, that might have greater appeal to an LGBTQ writer, I'm sorry, reader. And so that played into it. But the predominant reason is the one that I've already shared, that it's just like, I just wanted to spend time in Seattle, and it was my way to relive those neighborhoods. And, you know, when they go to like the video bar in the U district where he's got to find the geek guys to help him, you know, uncode the thing. I won't give that away. You know, then I'm able to like, oh, I'm going to put that in the U district because I love the U district and I haven't been there yet in this story. Right. So it's a way to travel streets and neighborhoods that just mean a lot to me. And I used to live in West Seattle for many years. So it's like that's where Orca Arms. You can figure that one out. That's where Orca Arms, his apartment complex is, where Hayden lives.
And I'll agree. I think there's something to what you're saying. There are exceptions. Richard Stevenson, his protagonist, Donald Strachey, he lives in Albany, New York. Lev Raphael's books take place in a fictional small town in Michigan. But as a rule, they are big cities. And my stories take place in Los Angeles. And I've had a very good number of people say they really like that they learned Los Angeles through me. So I think you are right on the money there. As a rule, people do like the bigger cities.
Yeah. And, you know, we've got a narrow lane as it is. So the wider we can make our already narrow lane, it's like, why not?
Well, and think of how many poor people died in Jessica Fletcher's town. A murder she wrote.
Yeah.
You can only get away with that so many times.
Yeah, true.
Something I want to touch on, and I would be remiss not to do so. You wrote in February, and this year is 2022, in an edition of Crime Reads, you published an article, and let's say it caused a stir. In fact, I only read it because I received messages from other authors who said, you got to check out what this guy said. The first thing you wrote, and forgive me, I'm going to be reading here. You wrote, according to an analysis by writingtipsoasis.com, a list of the most prolific 17 LGBTQ fiction publishers does not include any of the large publishing houses. Can't argue that. Instead, every publisher on the LGBTQ publisher list is a small independent catering specifically to the LGBTQ market. Conversely, the overwhelming majority of Lammy-nominated books are published by small houses specializing in the LGBTQ market. And then there are some that are self-published. And what you said is, I believe such disparity has contributed to a catch-22. By not having the benefit of the editorial polish, production values, and distribution and promotional strength that a large traditional publisher can bring to an acquired title, LGBTQ mysteries have been limited in their opportunities for marketplace. And I will say that there were comments, and I don't think anybody argued the distribution and the promotional part of what you had to say. But there were some comments, one by me, one by Ann Apteker, who's an incredible writer, Michael Nava himself, who's the managing editor of Amble Press. And I'm going to quote Michael. He said, I have to respectfully disagree with your characterization of small presses like Amble, the one I manage, as less professional, or any suggestion that our books are of inferior quality. And Ann McMahon, I mentioned, well, Bywater Books is a lesbian press. And Ann McMahon, who's been on the show, she is the director of creative services at Bywater. And I will say her most recent novel, Dead Letters from Paradise, is the best novel I have read this year. I loved it. So
did I.
I'd like.
I just
okay.
read it. I just read
okay,
it.
Okay, great.
It's wonderful.
So I'd like you to speak to the pushback that you've gotten from that.
Yeah. No, and I have to say, I really appreciate you bringing this up. I don't view it as uncomfortable. I view it truly as an opportunity to better convey my intention and also just own some error, right? Because I skipped over, for example, Kensington, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which was the publisher for Dean James, Simon Kirby Jones series.
I think they did Robin Geigel too. I'm not sure.
I trust you on that one. I just simply don't know, right? Which were great in the past. Michael Kraft, who has a new book out by, I'm going to have to check my notes. It's a Dante and Jazz series. Who's the publisher? Oh, Brash Books. Marshall Thornton with the Pinks video series. There have been some excellent gay cozies that have come before, and I am remiss in having not done a better job of the historical record on those. So straight up, I did a disservice to those writers. Now, it was never my intention to diss the books and the quality of the writing. Truly, truly, truly. I can see in the read of that how that is a totally legitimate takeaway. That was never my intention. My intention was a call to arms and a pointing out that the Big Five, to this day, to my knowledge, have not published a cozy that would be considered featuring a main character that is gay or lesbian. And to start with, it's like, I myself would love a deal with whether it's Macmillan or Simon & Schuster, pick your poison of the Big Five, because right away it's like, well, I'd rather have that royalty structure for starters. I'd rather have that distribution structure for starters. Now when we get into, is an editor at Doubleday better than Michael Naba at Amblin? I'm getting the name wrong.
Amble.
No, I would never with that thought front of mind would I ever say, oh yeah, I think that editor at Doubleday or Minotaur is going to be better. So that was, you know, if just like anything I write, if I could do a revise on that, I would absolutely revise that. My main intention, though, is true and I would hold to, which is I think it's high time that the big publishers do a better job of embracing diversity in cozies. There are some, Arsenic and Obodo by Mia Manansala is Berkeley. I think it's Jennifer Chow who just came out with Death by Bubble Tea. That's Berkeley. Kensington still has a couple coming out, Renovated to Death. Crooked Lane has a couple. Again, they're not the Big Five. So, you know, I'm never going to be in a airport bookshop. I still go into indie bookstores, right? And they don't have any Crooked Lane books, which is not a diss at the publisher. It's just there's unquestionably better distribution and your royalties are probably based off list price instead of, you know, net receipts. So that's a better deal too. So again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to that. And I regret some of it because I would revise it if I could. But some of it I hold to.
Well, thank you for clearing that up. And it's funny you mentioned the airports. I asked Cheryl Head, when will you feel like you're really successful? And she said, when I see my book at the airport bookstore. So, and that's going to be tough. Let's get out your crystal ball. Do you think we'll see a change in the not too distant future with that, with the Big Five?
I think so. And here's why. I've got a list. Because these books are in the bookstore. I'm sorry, in the airport bookstore. P.J. Vernon's Bathhouse, published by Doubleday, right? Penguin Random House. It's in the airport bookstore. It's got wide distribution, Big Five publisher. Now, it's a psychological thriller. It's the opposite of a cozy. But there is a very gay, I mean, you know, it's called Bathhouse. So it's a pretty racy read. But it's got, you know, Penguin Random House is the publisher. T.J. Clune, Tor, which is Macmillan, Under the Whispering Door. The other one is up on my, The House in the Cerulean Sea. That was the first one, right? So he's got a Big Five publisher. That's more fantasy, but it's gay fantasy. What else we got? Casey McQuiston's, right? Red, White, and Royal Blue, male-male romance. Now, One Last Stop. That's Penguin Random House, I think. Or maybe it's Macmillan with, it doesn't matter. Point is, there are a number of these where we're crossing genres, the one constant being LGBTQ plus main characters, plus fantasy, T.J. Clune, plus thriller, P.J. Vernon, plus male romance, Casey McQuiston, all Big Five publishers. I think it's just a matter of time now where, you know, we hold the constant of LGBTQ plus and we add cozy mystery. Because I really think the readership is out there. There was something, a recent article in Publishers Weekly citing statistics from a analyst from BookScan. And it was saying, oh, LGBTQ plus titles up from 2020 to 2021, double the sales. All sales went up because, you know, we're also in the middle of the pandemic. But across the board, it was 20% for LGBTQ titles. And those could be probably a mix of nonfiction to fiction and then all the genres within fiction, double. So I think that there's a market out there. And then there was also another article kind of running parallel about cozy mysteries and how readership there is up because people are seeking kind of an anecdote to just all of the divisiveness and the negativity. And if anything a cozy has is there's no violence and there's a happy ending. And they're pretty lighthearted, and there's usually some humor, right? So just tonally, they're giving a satisfying read and kind of scratching an itch that a lot of readers are having just because of the political climate and all that's going on with the world. So when you combine that, LGBTQ plus books just across the board are double 20 to 21 over those 2 years, and then add that cozy mystery readership is up. Hopefully somebody's going to write something that convinces Hachette or Macmillan or, you know, somebody. It's like, yeah, we're going to pay and we're going to invest and we're going to promote the heck out of this thing. And I truly believe it's a case that a rising tide will, you know, raise all boats, and that we'll see Michael Kraft's latest, you know, Desert Getaway. His book will do better because the whole subgenre will be proven to a greater extent. Not that he needs that to validate what he's doing, but I just think, just like P.J. Vernon's Bathhouse has done for the gay thriller, it's going to make it easier for the next gay thriller, because the agents will be able to cite that and its marketplace success. And so you don't have to be the first, because I'm guessing, you know, publishing, nobody really wants to be the first to prove a market when they have to make that kind of investment from the onset.
Yeah, and I will agree. Michael Kraft's Desert Getaway deserves to be with one of the top five. It's a great book. So let's go to the other thing that caused a stir. In the marketing for Devil's Chew Toy, it says that you coined the term cozy mystery, and I will say it's spelled Q-U-O-Z-Y. And it says that you firmly established a new subgenre of mystery. And on your website, it says you are proud to have created the literary love child of LGBTQ fiction and cozy mysteries. And you mentioned some of these names. I can say Derek Farrell would probably wonder what you're saying there. Mia Manansala, who you mentioned. Great writer. Marshall Thornton, who's Pink's video series. It's a cozy. It stretches the cozy a little bit, but most of it fits within the cozy category. J.S. Strange wrote a cozy. And then we have Ellen Hart. And she has published since 1989. Granted, it's questionable if they're cozies, but they are cozy-esque. And she was inducted into the Satan Sinners Hall of Fame. In 2010, she won the Trailblazer Award from the Gold Crown Literary Society. So again, let's...
She won the Grandmaster Edgar. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, Ellen's been around and she's done fabulous things and really paved the way for a lot of people. She deserved the Trailblazer Award. So do you understand why some consider your marketing technique deceptive, whether you meant it to be or not?
Here's my response to that, is I do believe it's a fair claim to say I coined the term cozy mystery, which is an absolute branding marketing tactic. Just like rom-com or whoever came up with the term bromance, intending, right? It is what it is. It's intending to carve out space and call this something. And I'm claiming that I came up with the term. And it is marketing. The claim on the term is clear. I'm okay with that because it's like I came up with it. So to say I wrote the first cozy is just marketing branding. To say I wrote the first ever cozy featuring a gay and lesbian characters would be false. And if people read it that way, then I probably need to revisit the language to make that more clear.
Yeah, because it was confusing to me. You started cozy, which I love that. You did a great job on branding that. But I can definitely see how people would be confused and kind of taken aback, like, wait a minute, there have been cozies coming around for some time now. So thank you for clearing that up as well.
Yeah.
So moving away from the controversy. So now I have what's called awkward questions authors get, as if we haven't already given you a couple awkward questions. And what I did, I surveyed 2 or 3 dozen authors and said, give me some weird questions that you've gotten or ones that are hard to answer. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to spin the wheel, and you are going to get one of the questions that was submitted back to me. So are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Okay. You actually kind of get an easy question because you've kind of already answered this. Why do your characters have to be gay?
Because I am gay, and I want to write characters that I can relate to and that I enjoy. This will be like my most spirited answer. If it doesn't come across in my volume or tone, believe me, it is. And because for 50 plus years of my life, I have read stories about straight characters in straight settings and straight communities doing straight things with no sign of a gay character. Mm-hmm. And I've enjoyed a lot of those stories. And I think it's high time that more and more straight folks give stories that feature either people of color or people that identify as LGBTQ+ or disabled or whatever the other might be, a chance. And I think in that they will find fun, interest, relatable characters, and some great, great stories and writing. I mean, I guess I only have interest in writing gay or lesbian characters, frankly. It's like the rest just doesn't interest me. And I think it's also just a product of my age. I had a birthday the other day. I'll disclose because I don't care, right? I'm 59. So it's like, I'm 59. I don't want to write straight characters. I'm not straight. Some of them interest me. I've got them in my book, but that's not what I want to do. That's not what I'm interested in. And I don't think that's what the world needs. Again, it's like, at least for the foreseeable future, there's going to be way more straight white cozies than there are diverse cozies. So, you know, why would I want to join the big pile? I want to do the more colorful, interesting thing as far as I'm concerned.
Very good answer. So, Rob, it has been a pleasure to have you on. As a reminder to everybody, my guest is Rob Osler, and his book is Devil's Chew Toy. It came out earlier this year, so that means you can go buy it right now. Thank you again, Rob.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.